Tonight I'd like to pick up in a book that we haven't gone through in quite some time. It's the book of Ecclesiastes. And the book of Ecclesiastes, let's face it, it's a book that has, it's another one of these writings of Solomon that people have questioned what's it even doing in the canon of Scripture, because it seems on the surface, let's face it, to be a book that's very, very nihilistic or pessimistic or fatalistic or skeptical. It's cynical. And it's just my kind of book, I guess. I know as a young Christian reading the book of Ecclesiastes, I did find a good portion of it kind of disturbing and confusing. And but here's the thing. It's like if you read in 1 Kings chapter 3, you read about how Solomon was in Gibeah and he had this dream. And in this dream, the Lord appeared to him. And the Lord said to Solomon, "Ask whatever you want of me, and it'll be granted unto you." And Solomon said, "Well, Lord, you know, I'm just a babe. I'm just a child. I don't have understanding and wisdom to lead this great nation of your people." And he says, "Yeah, what I would ask of you is for wisdom and insight and understanding so that I could judge correctly and lead your people in the right way." And God was so pleased with that statement from Solomon that God said to him, "Look, because you didn't ask for a long life, you didn't ask for riches, you didn't ask for fame or anything," he says, "I'm going to give you all of these things, and I'm going to also give you what you asked for. I'm going to give you wisdom. I'm going to give you wisdom to the extent that no one previously before you has ever had before, and no one will have to the degree that I'm giving you afterwards." In other words, apart from the Lord Jesus Christ, the wisest man that ever lived or ever will live is Solomon. So after reading that in Kings, I thought, you know, I'm going to sit at this guy's feet and see what he's got to say. And I've read his work over and over and over and over again. And this book of Ecclesiastes, I've struggled with it and struggled with it and struggled with it. And I'm thinking, this is from the wisest man that ever lived. So there's got to be some real depth to this thing. And believe me, there is. And I have found that the more I struggle with this book and the more I read this book, the more this book became one of my favorite books in the Bible. And in this book, people have made the mistake of not looking at this book with the right perspective, because what Solomon says, if I'm not mistaken, no less than 29 times throughout this book, he uses the phrase "under the sun." And that "under the sun" means here and now. In other words, Solomon takes a good, hard, cold look at life from a horizontal perspective. And he basically leaves out the vertical. In other words, if you're only going to look at life in the here and now and not look at it from a divine perspective, from an eternal perspective, from a spiritual perspective, then everything is vanity. Vanity of vanities, what he says. And what vanity means is empty, it's idle, it's useless, it's devoid of purpose or meaning. This is what life would boil down to if there is no God. And I don't know how many times I've said it, and I've come to that conclusion over and over again, that if there is no God, then all of life is a total meaningless joke. I don't care how you cut it. I don't care how you slice it. I don't care how you look at it. You cannot in any way, shape, or form convince me that life, you know, has any purpose if there's no God. That's what we need to keep in perspective, is that everything he's dealing with here, he's taking a good, hard, cold look at things in the here and now. Okay? What he talks about a great deal is, you know, death. And I am convinced that you have to look at life through the spectacles of death. You really do, in order to be able to see things clearly. You know, I am convinced of that. The greatest tragedy that I can think of is for people to live their life for X number of years and live their lives like unthinking cows. In other words, just chewing their cud day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, and decade after decade, and never come to the realization of what they're here for. Never come to comprehend what they were made for. Never come to the stark reality that, hey, we were made to know, love, and serve God with a whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. Because what happens with people like this, and believe me, there's a massive sea of humanity that falls into this category that never really seriously questions their existence. And to me, that's the epitome of ignorance. It's the ultimate in stupidity to never sit back and just say, hey, who am I? Where am I going? What's this life all about? I remember when I got back from Vietnam, I mean, you know, I began this search, and sure, it led me down a lot of the wrong roads, but at least I was searching. Sometimes I'd go to parties, and I'd be the biggest drunk there, but, you know, even in while I was drinking, I'd ask people, what do you think life's all about? And I'd always get the shallow answers. Well, whatever you want to make it, or, you know, just have a good time. Why worry about it? And my spirit would just scream within me, you know, is this it? I mean, what's the point to this? Because it was going nowhere as far as I was concerned. I think that, you know, what Solomon is trying to motivate people is to take a good, hard, cold look at their life. Don't just let it just be you're here today and you're gone tomorrow and never having come to the realization of what you're here for. And there was a movie years ago, too. It was called The Dead Poets Society. And in that, Robin Williams was I guess, a teacher at a high school there. And he was trying to point out, he's showing these guys all these pictures of past alumni, and he tries to get these kids to think, you know what, you know, all these people have in common? They're all pushing up daisies or daffodils or whatever, you know, they're all dead today. And so he uses this Latin term that says, seize the day, seize the day. And Gail will tell you, I have said this ever as long as she's known me, I always say, seize the moment. And if people know me, they know that's the way I am. I don't waste 1 minute. I'm always moving. You know, I'm always doing something because I'm trying to seize the moment. And that's what we need to do as Christians in every way. I don't care whether it's in your marriage. I don't care what it is. You know, it's like you got to seize what's there, you know, and grab it. Grab a hold of it now. I mean, when you think of the fact that the average American spends something like 56 hours a week watching TV, if you multiply that out, 56 hours a week, that's about 2 solid days a week. That's, 7 or 8 days a month. And then you times that out, that's, you know, almost a couple months in a year. And then you times that out to a lifespan, that's over 20 years of watching TV. Are people seizing the moment? Are they seizing the day? One of the things when we start reading this is keep something in mind. I wanted to know what this wise man had to say about life. And when I read it, no less than 6 times in this book of Ecclesiastes, the thing he said blew me away. Because what he said is he concluded that there's no better thing for a man to do than to enjoy his labor and to enjoy his food and his drink. Okay? Because it says this is a gift from God. And I'm thinking, is this his conclusion? I mean, this is it? Isn't there anything more profound than that? And the more I dwelt upon it, the more I thought about it, the more I reflected upon it, I'm saying, you know, that is really, really, really profound. Because you look at where we are at today. I have a good friend, and he had a beautiful home, beautiful home. And, you know, he did a lot of work in his home. It's just it was just an ideal home. But he wasn't satisfied. He wasn't content. So him and his wife decided, well, we're going to build this home. So they got another home. So they built this massive home. This, of course, probably worth $1 million or more. But, you know, they kind of have really, I think, got themselves over their head, all right, financially. And so the guy, he just learned that he came down with this these hives, and his face is all swollen and everything, and they don't know what's wrong with him. They thought it was an allergic reaction, and then it came back again. And he goes back to the doctor, and the doctor's saying, this is stress. This is stress-related. And, you know, I'm thinking, isn't that true about so many people today? We are in this rat race, and we're, you know, trying to accumulate all of these things, and look at the stress that we're bringing into our lives, and, you know, it's not bringing us happiness. What we need to learn to do is, like Solomon says, I've come to this conclusion that the best thing for a man to do is to enjoy his food and enjoy his labor. And at one point says, enjoy the life of your youth. In other words, you know, the simple things in life, you need to seize them now and you need to enjoy them now. I hardly dare ever even take a deep drink of water without, with every swallow of this in my heart, thanking God for this. This simple, ordinary thing that not only gives you pleasure, but, you know, it's just so life-sustaining that, you know, we take it for granted. And if we go without it, and I've gone 3 days and three nights without any water or food, and I can guarantee you, man, you would really appreciate a cold glass of water after a day of not having any. These simple things we take so much for granted, you know, is what we really need to focus on and just seize the moment. And if we're going through difficulties, going through trials, going through pain, going through this kind of thing, hey, still, seize the moment. What can you do to seize the moment? That's been my philosophy, and I really believe that that's what we need to do. I mean, I'm really rambling here, but I'm kind of setting the stage here because, you know, like with me, it's like if I can't do a particular thing because of something, like an injury, like I used to play racquetball every day. I used to love it, you know, play racquetball all the time. And then they changed my schedule at work, and then the club burned down. And so anyway, long story short, I couldn't play racquetball. So I said, well, what can I do? Well, I'll start jogging every day. So I'm out there jogging every day. And then, one time I was jogging and I tore my heel, Achilles heel or whatever, and it was hurting me for months and months and months. I said, well, I can't jog anymore. What can I do? Well, there's a lake out there. So I go swimming every day at the lake. You know, even if it's freezing cold, I figure, what can I do? Rather than, woe is me, I can't do this. Or woe is me, I can't do that. Well, you have to look at times, at life at times and say, well, what can I do to seize the moment, to seize the day, to grab what's in front of me? You know, that's what we need to do. Like Paul says, learn the secret of being content, enjoying what you have in life. Because if you're not content with what you have, you won't be content, you know, if you have a lot more. You know what I'm saying? Now, I've set this background on that. I'm sorry I took so long in it, but I think I needed to because of what we're getting into tonight. Anyway, this book was written by Solomon. It's written about 1,000 years before Christ, and this is what he says. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all the work which he does under the sun? Now, there's the key. There's the key phrase, all right? It's under the sun. Right? It's everything that we do in this life. Everything under the sun, of course, is everything in this life. Okay? It's not talking about the spiritual realm here. So, he's looking around and says, everything is vanity. Like I said, everything is empty or it's useless, is void of worth. I mean, I work in this grocery store and I see all of these magazines displayed every day in front of me. And, you know, you see guys, let's say, muscle magazines, and you see these guys all their muscles rippling, or you see the women on these glamour magazines and all this stuff that, you know, it's like, and I think of that often. I think vanity of vanities, you know, it's all meaningless, it's all devoid of meaning because these guys are going to be pushing up daisies, they're going to be pushing up daffodils in the very near future. I mean, I can't believe how fast time goes, can you? I can't believe it. The Bible says that 70 years are given man because of strength, some may live to be 80. And you know what's kind of interesting? The latest issue of Time Magazine, it says here, it talks about numbers. It says 77.6 years is the life expectancy for people in the U.S., all right, for America. It says it's actually up from 2003, which was 77.3 years. And I'm thinking, you know, we are the most advanced nation on earth, as far as our medical, as far as our technological advances, and as far as everything else, you know, as far as our pharmaceuticals, you name it. We are the most technologically advanced and medically advanced nation on earth, and yet the Bible says that 70 years are given a man, and because of strength, some will live to be 80. And of course, we know some people, you know, more and more people are living to be 100, but the average lifespan hovers right in that ballpark that Moses said, you know, God said, I'm going to give man 70 years. The stronger ones will live to 80, you know, but that's going to be the average. And here we are with all our advances, and it's still right in that average. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to be 56 in about 6 months or, you know, well, less than that in July.
One more year.
Yeah. And then I'm saying, okay, yeah, I'm thinking 50, I'll be 57. And it's like, in 13 years, I'll be 70. That sounds so old to me. And I'm thinking, where did my life go? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't feel it. Obviously, when I do, I mean, I jog almost every day, and I know that it's wearing and tearing on me because, I just don't have the speed. I still have the stamina, but I don't have the speed. I don't have the strength. I don't have the quickness I used to have. You know, but I can everywhere I look, I'm seeing the second law of thermodynamics. that is taking effect upon everyone. I mean, the second law of thermodynamics says that all things go from the simple to the complex. From the complex to the simple, it breaks down, deteriorates, falls apart, and dies. And that's what I'm seeing. And more and more, I'm in an industry where I'm seeing more and more older people. And they're coming through my line, and I look at their walkers, they got their canes, they got their mart carts, they're hobbling along, they've got, you know, their hair's falling out or wrinkled, and I'm just seeing it right before my eyes transpire that this is what's happening in life. And Solomon took a good, hard, cold look at this and saying, man, what's it all for? What's it all about? So that's what he's saying, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He says, what advantage does man have in all the work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Like I said, I mean, look at the generation going. You know, my folks' generation, their parents are already gone. You know, Gail's parents are gone. My parents, you know, my dad's 81, so he's well past that. My mother's pushing 80. You know, thank God they're in good health. They seem pretty, you know, vibrant for their age. But it's like, you know, my grandparents are gone, that generation, my parents are going, you know, most of their generation is gone. After they're gone, then it's my turn. You know what I mean? And it's like I'm looking at this, and that's what Solomon's looking at. A generation comes, a generation goes, but the earth remains forever. Take a look at that and ask yourself, what's it all about? Because I remember, you know, like I said, when I began my own search, I would lay in bed at night, and I'd just look up in the ceiling, and I think, what is this life all about? I would think to myself, one of these days I'm going to be 6 feet under the frozen ground, and if I'm conscious after that, I'm going to say, what in the hell was this all about? At least I was questioning things. I look around me today, and I don't see too many people even asking that question. But, you know, that's what you have to do. You have to look at life from death. Otherwise, I think you're going to miss it all. We got to recognize, hey, I'm going to die. Then what? You know, and if you look at life from that perspective, I think you begin to see things a little differently. And anyway, he says here, now he uses nature to bring home his point when he says in that verse 5, or actually back up to that verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place it rises there again, blowing towards the south and turning towards the north. The wind continues swirling along, and on a circular course the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. And you know, he's using three or four different examples in nature to show how things are just so wearisome and so monotonous and so repetitious, because he's looking at it and saying, where is this going? This is going nowhere. I mean, all the rivers flow into the sea. And the way he described it here, I mean, he's describing that, ingenious hydraulic creation of God, which he could take millions and millions and millions of cubic miles of water from the ocean and bring it up in the sky. And if you could consider that a gallon of water weighs something like 8 pounds, I mean, how does, you know, this God be enable us to, in other words, take this water, bring it up to the sky, water the earth, and it goes into the river, goes back into the sea, the sun picks it up again, and it's just a constant cycle. So, you know, he's looking at this and saying, where's it all going? What's it all about? And he looked the same thing as far as the wind, how the wind's, he says, it's going along in a circular motion. And we see in our really advanced, you can watch the TV, watch the weather station, you can see how the wind goes in a circular motion. It just, you know, continually circles around, and then comes around, circles again. And then he says, the sun rises and the sun sets. Well, you know, people have said, well, see, the Bible's, you know, so off base when it talks about the sun rising and the sun sets, because the sun doesn't go anywhere. It's the earth simply turning. With all of our technology and all of our knowledge and all our understanding about how the earth is rotating on its axis and rotating around the sun, we still use sunrise and sunset, don't we? We don't say the earth is turning. We say at sunrise, it's, you know, this is what the weather's going to be like. The sun sets at such a time, you know, right? We're still using the same terms today. that they used thousands of years ago, and it didn't mean he didn't know what was going on. It's just simply a term. And I just throw that out because, you know, I get sick and tired of dealing with these, you know, critics of the Bible. And I say, hey, sunrise, sunset, that's what we use today. We'll turn on your weather station or look in the paper, and that's what it says. Sunrise, sunset, right? And so it's just using the same terminology they used years ago. And then he says, all the rivers flow into the sea. The sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. And I remember having this feeling, having this sense. I was just like Solomon did, in a sense. In my search, it was like getting up, going to work, getting up, going to work, getting up, going to work. And, you know, I was saying, what's the point to this? What's the point? It was like, seemed like no point. And here I am doing basically the same job 38 and a half years later. You know, and my alarm goes off 4:30 in the morning or 4:45, and I'm up and I'm, you know, drag myself out of bed to go to work again. But now I'm looking at things from a totally different perspective. It's not like, well, this is going nowhere and I'm accomplishing nothing. I look at it from a totally different perspective. Even though it's wearisome, it's monotonous, mundane, I look at it every day. As soon as I get out of bed, the first thing I do is I offer the day up to the Lord and I ask Him to help me to give my employer an honest day's work. I ask Him to keep me from making mistakes or breaking things and help me get along with everybody, especially in the management, and I don't tick any customers off, and I just ask Him to help me with my day. And then as monotonous as my day is, I always thank Him for my job. I really do. Almost every single day I thank Him for my job, even though I find it really, really mundane. And I really would rather have the day off because I could get so much more done. But I thank Him for my job because I hear, you know what, I'm pretty fortunate. I have the health to go there and to be able to do a job, and I have the security, and I have a steady income, and I have the health insurance and the benefits and the pensions that go along with it. And how many people in the world don't have anything close to that? Even though I'll never be rich as a grocery clerk, you know, I'm just appreciative of what I have. You see what I'm saying? But when you don't put God in that equation, I mean, it is a rut. It is a rat race. You know, this seems so meaningless, so purposeless. And that's what Solomon's talking about there. Then he says here in verse 8, all things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Now, he says all things are wearisome, man is not able to tell it. I think that says a lot because he says man is not able to tell it. And then he gives an example here. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. Okay, the eye is not satisfied with seeing. That says so much, and it's so true because, like I said, If the people in this country spend 56, the average person spends 56 hours a week watching TV, then believe me, the eye is not satisfied with seeing. They can see rerun after rerun after rerun, and it's still the eye is not satisfied with seeing. And one of the things that always amazes me when you read about these perverts, these child molesters who would, you know, get arrested for molesting a child, and then they would find pornography. Either in their car or at their house, and they would find stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of these pornographic magazines, right? Or they would go get into their computer and find out that they've been, you know, they've just got thousands of different pictures, and you think, man, what's happening to these people? There's just an insatiable desire to the eye's not satisfied with seeing, so it becomes, you know, addictive. And they can't see that this is an addiction they need to be broken. It doesn't have to be child porn either. It could be any kind of porn. This is, for a man, pornography is more addicting than crack cocaine because the eye is not satisfied with seeing. And then the ear is not filled with hearing. I mean, you know, that goes without saying. A lot of times, I mean, you know, if you look at, for example, the biggest selling newspapers in the country are what? There are newspapers like the Enquirer or the Star or, you know, these, you know, tabloid magazines. And all it is the same rehashed hash, you know, over and over again. That's all it is. You know what I'm saying? But the ear's not filled with hearing. You know, we just don't see that this is empty. This is meaningless to it. You know, we just keep going at it. And so Solomon is taking, you know, standing back and look at that and saying, man, what's wrong with people? They can't see the emptiness of this. Man's not able to tell it. Then he says here, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. And that which has been done is that which will be done. So there's nothing new under the sun. In other words, everything's repeating itself. And like I said, I began to look at life and I began to see this constant, monotonous repetition. And believe me, it was just depressing because all I was looking at was from a horizontal point of view rather than looking at it from a vertical perspective. In other words, a divine perspective, looking at it from a heavenly perspective. He says in that verse 10, is there anything of which one might say, see, this is new? Already it has existed for ages, which were before us. There is no remembrance or of earlier things, and also of the latter things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come still later, or later still. You know, backing up to that verse 10, he says this, is there anything of which one might say, see, this is new? Already it has existed for ages, which were before us. Now you read that and people say, well, obviously that's a gross, you know, flagrant mistake there, because computers are new, telephones are new, cars are new, airplanes are new, this is new, that's new. I mean, Solomon never seen this in his generation, nor has there ever been before him, so this is new. But I say, no, look at nature, look at everything. You look at a computer. You know, there's not a computer on the face of this earth that can compare with that 3-pound mass of gray matter in your skull. All right? There's not a computer that can even come close to it. And here it is that God has made this computer that's 3.5 pounds that's existed long before man came along with a computer. Or you could take an airplane. Well, big deal. God has designed birds to fly for years. So there's nothing new there. Or you could take a receiver on a telephone. You can't compare with the ear. Or you could take, you know, your eyes. There's not a camera in the world that can compare to that. They say if you want people to beat a path to your door, build a better mousetrap. Well, you look at some of the mousetraps that you see in nature. For example, in some of these nature movies that you see a spider actually building a trap to trap his prey. Or, you know, one of the things that just intrigues me is just that God's ingenious, his creative genius. It just cracks me up and it just astounds me, awes me. Like, you know, they show these fish, these weird looking fish deep down in the ocean, and some of them have this thing hanging, this thing hanging right in front of their nose, but, you know, the fish itself looks like a rock. And this thing is just dangling. And then what that is a lure. And a fish will come by and try to grab it and then it'll snap. I mean, look at nature and you can see that, hey, nothing's new. All man is doing is just mimicking what has already existed for ages. And one of the things that if you stop and think about it, there is not a thing that a man can imagine in his heart or design that is new in this respect. Try to imagine yourself something that doesn't exist. All right. Now you could say, well, a four-headed man doesn't exist, but wait a minute. A man exists and a head exists. All you've done is just increase the number of heads. Try to think of something that does not exist, and you cannot do it. You can't do it. Whatever you try to imagine, whatever you try to create, is already existed. You just are rearranging what has existed. Isn't that phenomenal?
And we do that with ideology too. You know, somebody came up with this great idea and called it the New Age.
Yeah.
But if you look at the philosophy, it's been forever.
Been around forever. So when you're looking at this, you see what I'm saying? You got to look at it from a perspective that says, you know, he's right. Doggone it, the guy's right. There's nothing new under the sun. And it says here in verse 11, it says, there is no remembrance of earlier things, or former things, and also of the latter things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come still later. Now he's talking about people who existed long ago and people who will exist in the future. It's like people existed long ago. Sure, we remember them. I mean, we can remember them in terms of, we know, we remember Adam and Eve. We remember, you know, George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or any number of people. They can be remembered. But in a sense, he's talking about they're not in a position or they're not in existence where you can contact them, and they have no relevance in your life, in your everyday living. I mean, I even see this, unfortunately, I have to admit it, you know, in the past 2 years, you know, I buried my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, my sister-in-law. And every morning on my way to work, I pass their graves. And it's like, it amazes me because I think to myself, you know, I don't think about them that often, you know, when I'm driving by, because I'm in a hurry to get to work and I'm in this traffic and it's like, got to do this and got to do that. You see what I'm saying? And that's kind of sad to me. Of course, I remember them, but it's like, you know, life is going on. You see what I'm saying? I have no affinity with them anymore. That's been broken. You see? And then he says here in that verse 12, it says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given the sons of men to be afflicted with. So in other words, he just stood back and he began to observe life. And he began to, you know, to seek and explore wisdom concerning what God has ordained for man. And this is his conclusion in verse 14. He says, and I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. Now again, he repeats himself, but the key phrase is under the sun. Under the sun means he's only looking at it from the here and now. From the here and now. If all there is here and now, then you tell me, what's the point? There is no point. There's absolutely no point whatsoever. And there's not a person on the face of this earth that could convince me otherwise. And you know, and you have to look at it and say, you know, he's right. There's no point, because that's what he's saying. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, it's vanity and striving after the wind. If the evolutionists are right, that we all just came from some slime hole, some mud hole, and we're all going to end up in some dirt hole, and that's the end of it, then this is exactly his conclusion. That, behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. And in verse 15, what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. That's kind of significant because, you know, the way the die is cast, there's nothing you can do other than dealing with the hand that's dealt with you. It says what's crooked cannot be straightened. In other words, you can apply that to a lot of different things, but what I apply it to is man's fallen nature. Man is crooked in that sense, and that can't be straightened. In other words, if you look at it from a divine perspective, we're not to patch up the old man because the old man is crooked. You can't do anything about it. You have to crucify the old man. You have to kill the old man. The old man has to die and has to be a new creation. But you can apply this to a lot of different things, all right? The way God has done things, you can't change it. In other words, if God has said, hey, it is appointed unto every man to die once and then the judgment, can you change that? Can you change it? Not a person in the world can change that. I know when you're young and you're dumb and you've got all this vitality and you feel like you're immortal and you're going to live forever, you may have this thought in the back of your head, or at least this unconscious feeling that, well, when it comes to death, there's going to be an exception in my case. You know, it ain't going to happen, right? So what's crooked cannot be straightened. But then he also says what's lacking cannot be counted. And I think that's really significant too. Because if you remember, if you go back to the book of Daniel, I think it's the fifth chapter of Daniel, where Daniel interprets his dream for King Belshazzar, who's having this big rip-roaring party and this big orgy going on. They're drinking out of the utensils from the tabernacle. And then a hand comes and writes on the wall, meeny, meeny, take a little parson. And nobody can interpret what it means. And they finally bring Daniel in, and Daniel interprets for him and says, hey, this is what it means. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And tonight your kingdom is going to be given over to the Medes and the Persians. And that night, King Belshazzar was slain, and Darius and the Medes and the Persians took over the kingdom. Well, he says this, what is lacking cannot be counted. You know, just apply that to Judgment Day in this sense, in this respect. We're going to be weighed in the balances. And if there's something lacking, there's no way to make it up. You're not going to be able to do any sleight of hand or pull some lawyer trick to get this changed. It ain't going to change. And then in verse 16 it says, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I realize that this also is striving after the wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. Now, again, I think that this is very significant, what he's saying here, because he says, In verse 16, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. Now, something to think about. If, let's just say your pursuit in life is degrees, all right, to accumulate as many degrees as possible, that you are going to become, let's say, the most knowledgeable person on the face of the earth. I mean, I look at these college professors. I look at these people who pride themselves in all their great learning. You know, and I have to sometimes just shake my head and laugh because I just feel like, how can these people who are so, let's say, learned, be so stupid? And I'll give you an example. I mean, I used to think this of Carl Sagan. You know, he's been dead for years now. But, you know, this guy used to be on television as far as some of the nature programs, and he used to write all of these books, and the media used to hail him as being such a bright guy. But to him, the only eternal reality was the universe. He mocked at the idea of God, of the existence of God. To him, God was the universe. It was the cosmos. So there's nothing more than that. It just all came into being. And so what I'm saying is, here this guy had all his learning, all of this, you know, and he wrote all these books, and people just thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread as far as, you know, this guy's insights. Where is he now? He's dead. And so sometimes, you know, you got to look at it, and where's this all going if all we're going to do is just accumulate a bunch of knowledge? But if you take it from a vertical perspective and just say, hey, man, you know what the Bible says? Study. Show yourself approved unto God. A workman is able to divide the word of truth correctly. So if you start from a perspective that, hey, there's a God out there, and he created all things, then to me, I can't get enough knowledge, because everything I learn about his creation, it tells me just that much more about him. And I want to know about him. If I read a book, you know, if I watch a program, it's like what I want more than anything else. Teach me something. Tell me something I don't know about God. Show me something in his creation that I don't care if it makes me laugh, but I'll look at his creation and I will just marvel. One of the things that I've just always has intrigued me as far as God's ingeniousness is concerned is laughter. You know, I've written about it and I've thought about it and I've just looked at it from every perspective, and I just am always amazed at that phenomenon. There's nothing like it in the world. No other creature is capable of laughter. And what is laughter? I mean, Solomon says this. He concluded that from one perspective, it's just madness. But if you look at it, look at what is laughter? Isn't that ingenious? Isn't that incredible? What is laughter? I observe people. I sit back and I watch them laugh. And I think to myself, what an amazing thing that is. It's a release, an emotional release. And Solomon says laughter does good like medicine. I mean, laughter is good for you, you know. And yet you look around and it's something that we just take so much for granted. We don't even think twice about it. And yet if we stop and we look back, look, step outside of ourselves and look at it and say, man, isn't that an amazing thing? It's so amazing. It almost seems funny to me. I almost want to laugh about it because it's like, what is that? It's just, to me, it's just so incredible. What kind of a God could have the mind to create such a phenomena, and yet what would life be without it? Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? And, you know, so what I'm saying is, when you're reading this, it's like, you know, this is what I mean about accumulating knowledge. If all you're going to do is accumulate knowledge on a horizontal perspective, then it's all vanity, it's all empty. You could take all your worthless degrees with you to the grave. You know, I've said this so many times. I really feel like the people who should be out on the forefront of proclaiming the glory of God should be doctors, it should be astronomers, it should be scientists, it should be chemists, it should be biologists, it should, you know what I'm saying? These are the people that should be out there proclaiming the glory of God. And yet, ironically, it's the majority of these people, they deny his very existence. And I just say, what a paradox. That's incredible to me. So what I'm saying is, when you just pursue knowledge on a horizontal level, it's all empty, it's all vain, it's all meaningless, it's all going nowhere. And then he says in verse 15, verse 17, and I set my mind to know wisdom, to know madness and folly, and I realized that this also is striving after the wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. And you know that there's a lot of truth to that. I think that's it. There's a great deal of truth to that. I remember I was at college. I was taking this psychology class, and one of the things that we were required to do, and this is before I was a Christian, is that we were required to deal with some retarded kids, kids that had these mental deficiencies. And I went to this Laurel Ruff school, and I would just observe these kids. I was supposed to be taking notes and interacting with them. And the poor kids, I mean, they just didn't have any intelligence. But I was looking at these kids one day, and I'm just observing them, and something in me just envied them. Because the reason I envied them, I said, you know, these poor people are too unintelligent to even see their condition. And they just enjoy life, you know. And I'm looking at this and I'm observing this and I'm thinking, you know, I envy these people in that respect, because what Solomon's saying here, he's saying here that in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. And it's like the wiser a man, the more is grief, because in a sense, especially if you're just looking at it from a horizontal perspective, the more a person learns and the more a person begins to see and has insights to, the more, if he doesn't have a God that he can look to for answers, or at least be assured that the answers lie with him, then his grief is compounded, because he looks around, especially at suffering, and what answers does he have? Okay? He looks around and he's grieving. I mean, like I said, I mean, I think back before I became a Christian, and things used to just really, really bug me. I mean, things like just driving down a road and seeing nothing but billboards and even telephone poles and everything. And I'm looking around, I'm just saying, you know, what is this all about? I mean, it's just, there's no aesthetic value to that. There's no attractiveness to that. It's just clutter. It's just garbage. It's making, you know, it's just making a mess out of the scenery. I mean, even little things like that would just annoy me. The wiser man, the more is grief. And I was looking at things from a horizontal perspective. And certainly, if that's all you're doing, then you're going nowhere in terms of answers. Look at the wars, the rumors of wars. Look at the suffering. Look at the poverty. Look at the starvation. And if you don't have a biblical perspective, a divine perspective, hey, man, believe me, the greater your grief. You know. But even if you do have, I think, the greater your grief in many respects. But it's a totally different perspective that you're coming from. And you know that in the end, there's a purpose to it. But if you don't look at it from a divine perspective, then there is no purpose to it. It's all madness. And that only increases your sorrow and your grief and your pain and your frustration. I mean, it certainly did me when I looked at life just from a horizontal perspective. See what I'm saying? Yeah. So like I'm saying, we're in a book now that it's really deep. It's a book that's written by the wisest man that ever lived. And, you know, you'll never be able to plumb the whole depth of it because it's divinely inspired. And I'm thinking, hey, man, don't just skip over what he's saying and let it go in one ear and out the other, or don't get to the point where you twist his words, or you know you have to put everything in context. I mean, the cults and people that run off in the wrong direction will take what he says, but they don't look at it from a proper perspective, and then they'll come to a wrong conclusion about a lot of things. But this is what I'm saying. This book actually became one of my favorite books, but I wrestled with it for years. Sure. You know what I'm saying? Sure. Because I'm dealing with the wisest man that ever lived. So it's you know, I figured I'm going to sit at his feet and I'm going to learn something, you know. But it's not going to be by osmosis. I mean, it's not like you're going to put the Bible under your head and just wake up one morning and say, oh, I understand what he means now. No, you have to study it and study it to be able to see the worth that's there.